Across ABC Radio, this is Serene Damaki. Over the past year or so, let's face it, the world's been preoccupied with what can go wrong with our bodies. And there's nothing quite like a pandemic to focus attention on where our health vulnerabilities might be. And these days, if we're feeling unwell, people are likely to consult Dr. Google first before heading to a GP or other health professional. And yes, I am raising my hand. I'm guilty. I'm not kidding. I did this just a few nights ago. So much so that over a billion health-related Google searches are made every day. That's more than one in every 15 Google inquiries. Far out. Just think about that for a moment. But of course, unless you have medical training, you're very likely to misdiagnose the internet responses to your inquiries. And like people have done throughout history, go off on some wild and reckless treatment tangents. Melbourne Medico, Dr. Sarah Holper. Sarah is a doctor working in neurology. She's written a fascinating overview of what can go wrong with the human body and how people have responded over time to the symptoms they've observed. Sarah's published research on how poor communication from doctors can jeopardize patient care, as well as devising a world-first study identifying the brain region responsible for the aha moment when cracking a crossword clue. That doesn't happen to me enough, though. I need to find out how I can tap into that a bit more. The book's called What Is Wrong With You? An Insider's Guide to Your Inside. And Sarah joins us now. Hey, Sarah, welcome to Weekend Evenings.
Thank you, Serene.
The book takes you to so many places within our bodies, and it's grouped by these really, it's grouped around titles. So you've got brain, head, guts, mouth and throat, skin and itch. But I want to start with a bit of a song. So humour me for a moment. You write that this song by Peggy Lee terrifies doctors, and I want to know why.
Never know how much I love you. Never know how much I care. When you put your arms around me, I get a fever that's so hard to bear. You give me fever. When you kiss me, fever. When you hold me tight, fever. In the morning, a fever all through the night. Sunlight's up the daytime, moonlight's up the night.
So, Sarah, why does that word fever terrify doctors?
And oh, dear. Well, it's not so much the word fever. It's that last little lyric that we heard Peggy Lee sing there. She said, fever all through the night.
Ah, yes.
Now, night sweats are never normal. So your body temperature goes up and down throughout the day, and you should be at your coldest at about 4 a.m. Now, if you're hot at 4 a.m., so hot that you're getting sweaty, it tells the doctor that there's something going on in your body that means your immune system is working in overdrive, right? Because you should have a little dip at 4 a.m. So when we go to medical school, we're taught to ask patients whether or not they get sweaty at night. But sometimes, you know, people can get a bit sweaty, but what we're really interested in is drenching night sweats. So the question in our textbooks that we're taught to ask is, do you get so sweaty that you could wring out your pajamas in the morning?
But Sarah, hang on. I'm curious, isn't breaking out in a sweat, and I'm thinking about this in terms of my own daughter, in terms of myself, if she's got a fever that's running high, you're at the 38, 39 mark, and then, you know, we've gone through the night, maybe we've given her some medication just to help bring that down somewhat, medication fares off, and then she breaks into a sweat. So for me, and we sort of say at home, oh, great, the fever has broken.
Exactly right. So when you have an acute illness, so like a sort of a one-off illness like what your daughter might have, then you can certainly have fevers all around the clock. But what I'm talking about more is sort of, you know, over weeks or months, if you're having sweats every night, that's certainly abnormal. I don't ask patients if they could wring out their pajamas anymore, because I once had a patient who was an elderly man and he told me with a wink that he sleeps nude. So these days I say, can you wring out your bed sheets? But what you've said is exactly right. And sometimes we do give people paracetamol, for example, as a pill to decrease fever. In fact, in the 19th century, there were pills called chill pills. They're actually called that. So doctors used to tell people to take a chill pill. And this contains sort of a bit of quinine, which could help if you had malaria, but some pepper and powdered capsicum in this chill pill to try and break the fever, like you said.
Oh, wow. That's good. So there you go. So that's probably where the term then, or the phrase, yeah, just take a chill pill comes from.
It does indeed.
That my daughter sort of says to me every now and again, just chill, Mum, just chill. She hasn't added the pill part to it yet. You know what? Hearing you say that story is great, because that's something I really loved about your book. It's peppered, dare I say, with some really great stories as you go through each of the chapters and each of the sections. You take us back to a point in time in history related to medicine and in a really fun and engaging way. Do you have a favourite in the book?
Oh, that's so hard. Gosh.
I'm like, I want to ask it. I want to know, because there are so many good ones.
My favourite historical fact. I mean, the chill pill's pretty good. I mean, I talk in the book about the history of Listerine in the bad breath chapter. Now, Serene, do you know what Listerine was initially marketed as?
No.
I won't put you on the spot.
No, I don't. No,
that's okay.
No, I don't.
It was a floor cleaner. Oh. And then after it was a floor cleaner, it was sold as a treatment for dandruff and aftershave, and then as a treatment for gonorrhea. The idea was you sort of bathe your genitals in Listerine. And I should mention, actually, this reminded me, good fact there, the clap as a sort of way of referring to gonorrhea. That's because a treatment for gonorrhea used to be to, I hope no one's eating, to clap the penis between your hands and it would force the pus out. So you sort of clap it and then the pus that's in the urethra gets shot out. So that's why it's called the clap. But back to Listerine. Unfortunately, it didn't sell very well as a floor cleaner and aftershave and all of those other things. So it was rebranded as a treatment for bad breath. But bad breath is sort of a bit awkward to talk about. So they decided to refer to bad breath using a bit of Latin and use the term halitosis.
Okay.
And as soon as Listerine released their product as this medical treatment for this medical problem, halitosis, which previously no one had really recognized as a problem, you know, bad breath wasn't really talked about, their sales went absolutely through the roof. So they had these marketing campaigns in the 20s where they came up with the phrase, often a bridesmaid, but never a bride. That comes from Listerine. And the idea was that this poor woman's halitosis, this medical problem, was the reason why she was never getting married. And as a consequence of encouraging halitophobia, fear of bad breath, Listerine's revenue went from about $100,000 per year, $100,000 US in 1922, to $8 million. In 1929,
wow.
Just by promoting this sort of fear of bad breath. And it reminds us that we're all so anxious about our bodies and how it works and how it can go wrong.
And how
companies that capitalize
on it all,
and
exactly,
make a lot of money from it.
Oh,
indeed.
Dear. But reading your book, I got the sense that this author had a ball writing this book. I don't know. That's the sense I got. Well, I was just
loved it. Okay. Oh my gosh! Honestly, if I didn't have an editor, it would be four times the length. The number of little anecdotes and historical stories that I've put in there. They're all of my favourites in there. That's why I couldn't pick one.
It also made me think, aside from that, because it's fun. You can tell you're having fun, and in turn I was having fun with you. And it made me think, I wonder what the driver was. So what made you write the book?
Yeah, well, look, I've learnt lots of things working as a doctor, like how dangerous ladders are. Never climb a ladder, honestly, or the perils of playing squash without goggles, because Serene, believe me, eyeballs can burst like grapes. But above all, what I've learned is that everyone is fascinated by their body, how it works, why it goes wrong, how it can go wrong. But the problem is, like you said before, unless you go to medical school, you're never taught how your body works. You're never taught how to interpret common medical symptoms. Like, I had no idea that I even had a spleen before med school, let alone where it was or what it did, right? So I found that what most patients want from their doctor isn't a diagnosis in Latin. It's an explanation in English about what's wrong with them,
what's going on,
actually going on inside their body that's making them feel sick.
Mm.
And that's why I wrote the book, really, to explain what's wrong with you, because I think it's fascinating and I think it's unfair that doctors have a monopoly on this fascinating body-based information that everyone wants to know about.
Mm. Well, we in my intro, we was mentioning Google and Dr. Google, that it's called Dr. Google, we'll kind of get, but it's off the cuff. We say, all right, let's just go and check Dr. Google. It's incredible, the number, in terms of how many people jump on. And I mentioned that I put my hand up, and yes, I'm guilty. Is it somewhat, do I get a big naughty serene for saying that, look, I do Google sometimes, you know, I've got this, I've got that, I'm feeling this, I'm feeling that. But what I am focusing on are the pages and the sources of information for which I am deriving just some sort of information. I'm not looking necessarily for a diagnosis. It's like you said, I'm fascinated with what could potentially be going on. It's not necessarily to just stop me from going to the doctors at all, but I do go to Google, but I do focus on, well, hang on, what sources am I clicking on to find out a bit of information? Is that okay?
Gold star for you. Absolutely fantastic. Never stop being curious. That's exactly what you should use Google for. It's fine to be Googling anatomy or to be reading on reputable websites about, you know, how your body works, but you hit the nail on the head. We want you to stop before you get to the point where you say, okay, so
that's
I
what
must
it is.
Have leprosy.
Mm.
You know, it's fine to be curious, not only fine. I'd love it if every patient was like you and was curious and trying to work out more about their body. I think that getting the information from a good source, so, you know, government websites or there's, you know, the neurology associations or cardiology associations make facts pages that are fantastic. Mm. Books, you know, that's a large reason why I wrote this book, to give you a reputable source for information about your body. But so long as you stop short of the point where you then make a diagnosis. And I think that it's only natural that we turn to Google when we have questions. Google is our resource for finding the nearest cafe, for finding the nearest mechanic. Of course, it's going to be where we turn when we have questions about anything, including our body. But I think that we need to follow up our Dr. Googling with a Dr. Holper or Dr. Other person to just clarify exactly what we've seen there. Because it can be a bit scary when, you know, oh, it could be cancer, but it could be something else if that's the answer that Dr. Google gives you.
Mm. And as we were mentioning a little bit earlier, in terms of the way you've grouped the titles in your book and looking at the body and brain and head, guts, mouth and throat, skin and itch, there's so much packed into it. And you're right in the way you say that even just in the chapter section, you have fun little anecdotes and fun little one-liners that you throw into it that, like I said, is very enjoyable to read, but also very thought-provoking. I'm like, and then you ponder on that for a moment. It's like, okay, I'll keep on reading on. So you definitely grab the attention. You look at circadian rhythms when it comes to sleep. You look into this. Tell us a bit about that.
Yeah, well, circadian rhythms, I mean, most people have probably heard of that in terms of your sleep-wake cycle. And if we just look at the word circadian, it comes from the Latin words meaning about a day. And it's a deliberately vague term, about a day, because circadian rhythms aren't actually 24 hours long. And I'll explain why in a sec. So if we just look at our sleep-wake cycle, that's the most obvious example of circadian rhythms. Every day you've got two hormones that go up and down to make you sleepy and alert at the right times. So the sleepy hormone is melatonin, and that's made and released by your pineal gland, which sits in your brain. And the word pineal is from the Latin for pine cone because it's shaped like a pine cone. And coincidentally, it's the same size as a pine nut. So very easy to remember when you're studying your anatomy. So every day the melatonin is made by that pineal gland, seeps into your bloodstream, and your blood's concentration of melatonin peaks at about 3 a.m. when you're deep asleep. And then at that point, the opposite hormone, the wake-up hormone called cortisol, begins to start to rise. And cortisol is made by your adrenal glands, which sit on top of your kidneys, and they look exactly like melted cheese, sort of melted on top of your kidneys. They're bright yellow, beautiful glands. So this sort of seesaw of melatonin and cortisol over the day helps you to be awake and alert during the daytime and sleepy at nighttime. If you think about your cortisol levels, they're actually at their highest at 9 a.m., and Interestingly, if you look at big data sets, most heart attacks happen between 6 a.m. and noon because your cortisol levels are really high at that time, your blood pressure's high, your heart rate's high, and that drives the strain on the heart that leads to heart attacks. But if we think more broadly about circadian rhythms, it's not just your sleep-wake cycle. So like we discussed before, your body temperature fluctuates over the day, should be at its lowest at 4 a.m. Digestion pauses overnight and is higher during the day. There's lots of patterns in the body that last around 24 hours. And the way that we actually found this out, that we have these patterns in the body, were due to some very interesting experiments done in the 1960s by this German doctor called Jürgen Aschoff. Now, Aschoff built this underground bunker and he tried to get volunteers to come in and live in this bunker for weeks or months at a time. I don't know how he recruited Serene, because if a German doctor said to me, oh, I'd like you to come into my underground bunker, yes, yes, I'm a scientist, I'd probably say no, but presumably all of those tropes from horror movies hadn't been established by in the 1960s. Anyway, Aschoff got these people to live in this bunker, no light, no windows, no clocks, and he said, just try and be normal, okay? So they'd eat when they felt hungry, they'd sleep when they felt sleepy, they could wake up whenever. They had no idea what time it was. And Aschoff watched them and documented when they slept, when they ate, what their temperature was. They had this rectal probe in for the whole time that was keeping track of their temperature. It wouldn't have been very comfortable. But at the end of all of these experiments, Aschoff stepped back and had a look at all of his plots. And he was astonished to find that all of these biological functions he was recording, hunger, sleep, temperature, they all fluctuated over about a day, so 24.9 hours. And that's where circadian rhythms come from. But if you think about that for a moment, isn't that fascinating that, you know, we live on a planet that happens to rotate at a speed that means that the sun is overhead about every 24 hours. You know, Jupiter, for example, their day lasts 10 hours. On Venus, it lasts about 240 Earth days. But if I were to lock you, Serene, in a bunker, which could be on Jupiter for all you know, your body doesn't know what planets it's on, your body's functions would still operate in cycles that are 24 hours long. It's like the Earth's speed of rotation is somehow entrenched into your DNA, which I think is absolutely fascinating. It's not a cosmic coincidence, of course. It's evolution. So animals like humans, we've got to do the right thing at the right time to survive. Now, before we could just switch on a light, we had to do all of our productive activity like hunting during the daytime. And when the sun went down, we don't have very good night vision. So that's when we'd have to retreat and go to sleep. So natural selection via evolution or evolution via natural selection meant that the people who did go to sleep at night were more likely to survive than the people who were stumbling about and tripping over roots at nighttime. And that's how our circadian rhythms evolved. And if we try and mess with those circadian rhythms from night shifts or jet lag, that's when we can start to feel really, really crook because, you know, our digestive hormones are being released at the wrong time. You're eating a croissant when your stomach thinks that you should be asleep.
Yeah, you should be asleep.
Exactly right. And if you look at, you know, human error catastrophes like Chernobyl, that happened at 1:30 in the morning. Three Mile Island, that was at 4 a.m. You know, the Bhopal gas leak at 1 a.m. We're really not supposed to be doing cognitively taxing tasks overnight. And when we try and push ourselves, errors can occur. I certainly can't spell penicillin in the middle of a night shift.
And we can't force it either and try and change it either. Interesting.
Exactly. And jet lag is such a modern thing because before the era of, you know, high-speed jet travel, humans had never been able to travel fast enough to warrant a shift, you know, in time zones, as it were. So jet lag really is a very modern plight.
And for our listeners, yeah, you've got to grab this book and read it and check out the jet lag story that Sarah's got in the book. That's about the sailors, right? Sarah, am I right?
Yeah, that's right.
It's good. Oh, if you've just joined us, you're with me, Serene Damaki, on ABC Radio's National Weekend Evenings. We are speaking with Dr. Sarah Holpers, a doctor working in neurology, and we're talking about Sarah's new book, What Is Wrong With You? An Insider's Guide to Your Inside. Look, we've got to go on to this awkward topic that you explore in your book on hair and balding.
Oh, balding. Look, I think that people shouldn't feel too bad about going bald because lots of famous people have gone bald. For example, Caesar. Good old Caesar, as his empire was expanding, his hairline certainly wasn't. It was very rapidly receding. And Caesar hated it. He said that, you know, it was a disfigurement that really troubled him. And Caesar used to go for a comb over. So he used to comb his hair forward and that didn't really work. And so then Cleopatra made up this sort of concoction of powdered horse teeth and deer bone marrow that Caesar would slather onto his head. No idea why she picked those animals. I guess they're both hairy, so maybe that's why. Didn't work. So what Caesar decided to do was to wear a laurel wreath to hide his receding hairline. So that's why Caesar is always pictured wearing a laurel wreath. Usually they'd only wear it, you know, at ceremonial occasions. Caesar wore it all the time to cover his balding head. But it's not Caesar and men who go bald. We've actually all gone bald before we were born. So let me explain. When you were in the womb at about 14 weeks or so, you were covered in hair, Serene. Not just you, everyone was covered in hair. It's about 2 or 3 centimetres long and it's called lanugo, which means wool.
Oh, my mum calls it cashmere hair.
Like cashmere. It's very, very soft indeed.
So she's not way off. She talks about the soft little hairs on my back. I just constantly, as I was a kid, that's your cashmere, Sidine. You don't cashmere touch it. Yeah.
Beautiful. But this lanugo, it sheds by the time that you're born. So at the time when you're about the size of a coconut, so 22 weeks of gestation, covered in this hair everywhere, on your face, on your stomach, on your back, everywhere. And then what happens is that you shed it all into your amniotic fluid that's around you. So you've got this sort of like fluidy, hairy, disgusting fluid around you. And then where does it go? Well, Serene, you eat it. So when you were in the womb, just before you were delivered, it's sort of 7 or 8 months, you swallowed and ate all of that lanugo hair. So by the time that you're born, it's in your bowels. And that first bowel movement that you have called meconium, that if you look at it closely, which I do not recommend doing unless you're wearing, you know, 3 masks and a face shield, it's quite pungent. If you looked through it, you would see that there is the remnants of that fetal fleece, that cashmere-like hair in there. So everyone has gone bald by the time that they're born, but some men happen to go bald again when they hit 40.
Yes. And I have to ask, Sarah, where do you stand? I wonder, do you explore this? What are your I wonder if you explore this or think about this. Where do you stand on old wives' tales, like the mother's stuff that comes about that's passed down from generation to generation? I don't know if they're called superstitions. One prime example for me is when I first had my legs waxed when I was about 12 or 13, my mum told me immediately to run into the shower and pee on them so that they don't grow back like that. He used to.
That is hilarious. I have not heard that one.
Okay.
Look,
I'm Lebanese background, so this could very much so be a cultural, because you have that aspect as well, right? You've got cultural traditions that are passed
absolutely
down.
Look, I mean, urine is a really good example. People have said that urine can cure everything. So it was a sore throat gargle. You know, you urinate, it was a cure for acne, washing your face in urine. Urine's a particularly common one in the old wives' tales. I think that you've got to look at each of them individually, but certainly urinating on
it did
your
sting
legs,
like hell, that's for sure. Other than that, it would sting.
So don't do that anymore. I'd suggest that what you should do.
Thank God for laser is all I can say.
Oh my gosh, I know. Just flush your urine down the toilet. Yep. That's probably the best thing to do with it.
Sarah, it's been so wonderful speaking with you. Congrats on this wonderful book. And look, it's great because, as you said, it's kind of aimed at that opportunity for, yes, okay, there's Dr. Google, but it is aimed at that opportunity to really hit that curiosity lever on our body and what's happening on our in our body in a very fun and engaging way. Well done.
Thanks so much, Serene.
Dr. Sarah Holper there. And her book, of course, got to remind you, What is Wrong with You? An Insider's Guide to Your Insides.
With Serene Damaki on Weekend Evenings.